I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Young women of color face a unique set of challenges and barriers. President Obama described them in vivid detail last September when he spoke at an awards dinner for the Congressional Black Caucus.
And although in these discussions, a lot of my focus has been on African-American men and the work we're doing with My Brother's Keeper, we can't forget the impact that the system has on women as well. The incarceration rate for black women is twice as high as the rate for white women. Many women in prison, you come to discover, have been victims of homelessness and domestic violence, and in some cases, human trafficking. They've got high rates of mental illness and substance abuse, and many have been sexually assaulted, both before they got to prison and then after they go to prison. And we don't often talk about how society treats black women and girls before they end up in prison. They're suspended at higher rates than white boys and all other girls. And while boys face the school-to-prison pipeline, a lot of girls are facing a more sinister sexual abuse-to-prison pipeline. Victims of early sexual abuse are more likely to fail in school, which can lead to sexual exploitation, which can lead to prison. So we're focusing on boys, but we're also investing in ways to change the odds for at-risk girls, to make sure that they are loved and valued, to give them a chance.
And that's what our guests are doing, working with young women of color to help them build their self-esteem and to grow into strong and successful women. Let me introduce the three of them to you. Cheryl Ann Wadlington, founder of the Philadelphia nonprofit Evalor, just recently named a champion of change for extracurricular enrichment for marginalized girls by the White House at the White House on Friday. Congratulations. And Cheryl, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us is Shalia Sutton, founder of the Uniquely You Summit, and that's an annual forum in the greater Philadelphia region where black girls ages 11 to 18 address the complexities of being black and female in America. And Shalia Sutton, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests is Robin Stevens. She's an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, also directs Penn's Health Equity and Media Lab. And Robin Stevens, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have all three of you with us. And the president talked about My Brother's Keeper. Cheryl, do we need My Sister's Keeper to bring the same kind of attention on girls at risk?
We most definitely do. My Brother's Keeper has been around for some time. But what has happened, girls of color have been left out of the conversation historically. And the thing is that we're seeing that there was actually no data around that could tell us the issues that and the challenges that were affecting girls of color. So within the past 5 years, several genius professors got together and they compiled the data, and it was a magnificent thing. So the data is out and it says that girls of color are the fastest growing population going into the juvenile justice system. They're sexually assaulted three times more likely than any other race or ethnicity. Four in 10 will drop out of high school. So there are a number of issues that have been revealed through several reports. But also, even in sports, they're finding that the Title IX really has not impacted girls of color in terms of them being able to be involved in sports in what they are calling the high poverty schools.
Well, Shalia, and to everybody, Philadelphia has the highest rate of poverty. Certainly Camden has a high rate of poverty. Philadelphia has the highest of the top 10 cities. Other cities in this region where girls are growing up also having to deal with the issue of poverty. How does that impact girls of color in particular?
Wow, I don't even know where to begin really on that one. Just as the president mentioned, unfortunately, girls end up in situations that they're not ready for based on that. So you've got a young lady perhaps that very well may, live in a situation that is compromising, where she may end up having to sell herself, to survive, sell herself to, take care of her family. Sometimes it's coerced. Sometimes, it's voluntary. And unfortunately, just as as the president said, sexual exploitation sometimes leads to prison. And so, you know, there was a huge bust here not too long ago, I think, around sex trafficking. There was a young man who was sex trafficking women in Montgomery County, and it was a huge bust. I think there was probably about five or six women of color that he had involved in that scheme and in that. And I think that they were in that for about 5 to 6 years, some of them had said, and had been in and out of prison. So you have girls that are between the ages of 14 and 18, you know, being involved in that type of lifestyle. And unfortunately, you know, sometimes it's not by choice.
Well, and the president talked about the sexual abuse to prison pipeline. Yes. I mean, making that connection there. You've done a lot of work, Robin, in Camden across the river here. What can you tell us? Is there something unique about Camden?
I wouldn't say, I mean, Camden is unique and wonderful because it's Camden, just like Philly is unique and wonderful. But I think the problems that, or the struggles that girls have to fight against are similar, particularly when you see communities that the infrastructure and the government has basically divested from. And so we are having children come up in situations they are not choosing where they're born. We all are in a birth lottery, and they end up living in a community where they are marginalized, where they don't have libraries, where they don't have great schools. And then they have to develop in those circumstances. And so we see people being strategic. We see people not always making our favorite choices, but sometimes they're very rational choices around survival. And I think the question we need to ask as a country is this what we want for any of our children?
Mm. Right. Absolutely.
And you use the word survival. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a powerful word.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning life or death.
Meaning life or death. So sometimes it makes more sense to engage in a risky behavior or to trade sex for shelter.
Right.
It makes more sense than staying on the street at night in Philadelphia or Camden. I mean, really, it is a rational choice to do that, or to be able to provide food for your younger brothers and sisters. Those are rational choices that many of us would make in those positions, except these are still children.
Right. And we're talking about children. We're talking, what, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, you know, teenagers, obviously.
Most of the children, people I work with are 13 and over. I'm sure you've had experiences with even younger girls.
Yeah.
Cheryl, you wrote a book, and it was a part of kind of self-help book, but also a bit of a memoir. And you have lived some of this, if I can say it that way.
Exactly. You know, I am still trying to figure this out, and I was wondering how I got involved in working with girls. And then I said, oh, my God, it's because I was once that girl. I know who she is. I lost my father in his sixth grade, and after that, I just started acting out. Therapy was not a big thing in the African-American community. I come from a Christian background. So, of course, everything that was going on, my mother took me to church. And church was supposed to be the healer, or in some cases in our community, herb, you know. And that's
didn't work
historically. No. So I just acted out and got in trouble and actually was in reform school. And so
sent away then?
Sent away. You know, I was a very mischievous girl. So I said, oh, my God, as I got older, I said, well, how many girls of color are there out there that don't have a daddy? And then what are the sociological and psychological effects of what can happen to a girl when there's no daddy around? Now, luckily, I didn't get involved with the boys, but I was a very mischievous girl.
Meaning you got in trouble.
Oh,
a
big
lot?
Trouble. Suspended maybe 50 something times.
Wow.
You know, where they
were you sassing your teachers and things like that?
A lot of that and more.
Yeah.
And again, it was wanting attention that I wasn't getting from a male figure, and that daddy love. That is really powerful and can do something to a young girl. And I didn't know any other thing to do, you know. Again, therapy was not there, which is what I'm sure I needed.
Well, something must have worked because here you are.
Well, I can tell you what worked. Okay. It was women stepping up to the plate to mentor. And so it's the same thing that I'm talking about doing now and what all of the ladies here do. When you have the power of the woman, powerful women coming in and uncompromising women to step up and to give girls the mentorship and the quality education they deserve, things can happen. So, you know, it got me all the way to the White House.
Yes, it did. Shalia, this is part of what you do, right?
It is.
Mentoring?
It is.
What do girls tell you about
their
lives?
Oh, they tell us a lot. The beautiful thing about our program, there's a spectrum of young women. And what happens is, you know, we've got girls who come from two-parent homes where you've got lawyers in the home or, you know, a professional mother. And then you have on the other end of the spectrum, we have girls who come from group homes and shelters. So they're parentless. So we see the range. And it is beautiful to really see them interact on a peer mentoring level as well. Mm-hmm. We've seen that within the organization. That is super important to the work that we do. We've learned that they don't want to hear from us all the time. You know, a lot of the women sometimes we bring in, you know, well, we're looking because our demographic's getting younger and younger. And, you know, the organization is getting older, that we're seeing women who are coming in that very well may be their grandmother's age. So what's happening is we're, you know, finding youth leaders who can actually tell their peers the same things we're trying to tell them. And it comes across much differently than the way, right, you know, if it were to come from Cheryl or if it were to come from myself. And it's like, we've been telling you this for 7 years, you know, but to take someone that's 18 and that person's also 18 and to see them lead in that way, those girls are really, really interested in that. So peer mentoring has been so successful in the work that we're doing.
And what is the message, if it's possible to distill it down?
There's so many. Our mission, our true mission is to help Black girls uniquely define, discover, and become who they are. That is the work that we do. So it's beautiful to see a young Black girl who is 17 or 18, who's been 5 years in the program, and she's fully self-actualized. She understands who she is, where she comes from, and where she's going. And I think that the message is, maybe it is an unspoken message in a way. I think to see someone your age carry themselves in a certain way and be self-assured and understand where they come from and where they're going, you have no other choice but to be interested in following suit.
I mean, self-esteem, we're almost up in a break here, but to you, Robin, self-esteem is, I mean, it's a powerful word. It's been, I think, interpreted many different ways. How do you see that, especially as it relates to girls of color?
So I don't really work in self-esteem because it can go either way.
Right.
But I think about, and I think that the core of what you're getting to is a girl realizing she is of value because
yes,
she is. That's the only, you just her very being. And part of what we see in the work that I'm doing on social media are girls and boys, but girls trying to define themselves based on what they think is of value to society. And unfortunately, the way society values Black women is as a co-star, as a side for a male story, not as the star of their own story, as an object, as a sexual object, as an object of beauty, or as deviant. And we believe, and I think all of us are pushing, that there's much more to Black femininity mm-hmm. and the intersection of race and gender than just these two dichotomies of either you're beautiful or you're tough.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Robin Stevens. Also with us, Shalia Sutton and Cheryl Ann Wadlington. And we are talking about Black girls, self-esteem, girls of color, growing into successful and strong women. You can join our conversation. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let me just briefly reintroduce our guest. Robin Stevens is an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, also directs Penn's Health Equity and Media Lab. Shalia Sutton is founder of the Uniquely You Summit, and that's an annual summit here in the greater Philadelphia addressing the complexities of being Black and female in America. Cheryl Ann Wadlington, founder of the Philadelphia nonprofit Evalure House, just named a champion of change by the White House. 1-888-477-9499. That's the number to join our conversation. Robin, let me go back to you because I am interested in the research you've been doing on the digital neighborhood. Mm-hmm. We all have one, right? And the geographic neighborhood and what you're finding in some of your research.
So, excuse me. So the digital neighborhood or the digital hood is really where I've been focusing. It's looking at the lives of teens, considering all of the digital media they use.
Which is a lot,
and it can be different. And I know you ladies have all seen, sometimes it's Snapchat, sometimes it's Periscope, sometimes it's Facebook. Certain platforms have different uses. They evolve over time. Parents probably never see the true version of any of the platforms. But what is going on is in the digital neighborhood, we're all familiar with these spaces, but no one really, what happens in one person's social network is invisible to mostly everyone except the people in their social network. So what's going on in the lives of young Black girls is visible to other people in their network, but not necessarily to the rest of us. Mm-hmm. And so some of the things they're telling us that they are seeing and they're experiencing, some of it is really troubling and it's not commonly known.
Well, give us an example. I mean, what do you find?
One is the amplification of violence. So before, back in the day when I was a kid, there was a fight. If you were after school, you saw it. But if you weren't, you heard about it. Now you see it because it's filmed and it's replayed. Someone's shame is shown over and over. So that forces people to retaliate and it escalates violence. It also creates a situation where your neighborhood can feel even more dangerous because when you pull up your feed, you're seeing this happened on SEPTA. She punched him. This happened. This happened. This happened. All that violence is constantly replayed. And it starts to feel maybe normative when really it's these are anecdotal or incidents. That's one. Two, girls, they face a difficult time on social media because in one post, they'll be tagged as being teen virgins. And in another, they'll be tagged as being hoes. So there's like very little space for sexual development. For girls, girls are very aware that everything they do can be reposted and tagged. It's not uncommon to have a sex tape in a high school now, whereas in my day, it would have been like a shock and awe situation. But now girls talk about it like, yeah, that happened. And so there's this performance of things that aren't, I don't think, really soul quenching or soul building for girls. And also you don't get popular for posting pictures of yourself studying. You get popular for posting pictures of yourself in a bikini. That's a perverse incentive.
Well, and that raises, of course, a whole host of questions. And I'm just curious from your perspective, Cheryl, but also to you, Shalia. So how do you intervene? How do you counter those messages? Yeah. How do you talk to girls about that?
Well, we do a lot. Now, two things from what both of these wonderful ladies have said that I think needs to be talked about what we call Black and brown girl healing.
Black and brown girl healing.
Healing needs to take place. And whatever the effects of what Black women and girls of color have to experience have been historical, because we can go as far back as to one of our presidents, you know, used to refer to women of color as woolly hair wenches or something like that. So those things have been passed down through history of how they view us. Right now, the data shows that Black girls are looked upon as oversexed and unsophisticated. This was released in the data. And so they're referring to how teachers are looking upon students. So when they were talking about young girls being pushed out of school and expended and expelled. So the Black girl and brown girl healing is one thing. The other thing that we understand at Evalore House is you cannot punish our girls for growing up in unhealthy environments. And what all of us were talking about, that's what it boils down to. So we also know they're not getting the help they need in school because of the counselor situation.
Certainly in Philadelphia, yes.
Right. At one point, we were among the worst in the country. So you have this myriad of traumatized girls who there's nowhere to go to receive help. So when we see the behavior, that's where it's coming from.
Well, I wonder too, Shalia, whether if we're talking about traumatized girls or girls who are growing up in difficult, sometimes violent circumstances, whether what looks like bad behavior is really an expression of pain and suffering and loss and a sense of feeling alone in the world.
Oh, it absolutely is. It absolutely is. Cheryl hit on something, you know, when she was talking about, you know, the sort of the messages and, you know, when you look at reality television or when you just look at, let's just take television altogether, leaving the reality part out. When you look at the types of characters, you know, whether they be reality, whether they be, you know, paid actresses, you take something like Orange is the New Black. So the women that are in that are prisoners. They're Black women who are prisoners. Then you take reality shows like Love and Hip Hop. And you take a reality show like Basketball Wives LA. So the same messages that non-Black people get about Black women are the same messages that Black girls get about themselves. So they're the same messages. There's the same messages that Black men are getting about Black women. Okay, that's how they like to be treated. Okay, that's how I handle a relationship situation. That's how I handle something traumatic. Okay, so that's how I react in a situation like that. Name one positive platform. The young Black woman right now, or a group of young Black women, can any of you name that positive platform right now on television?
Right. I mean, I was thinking Olivia Pope, but I don't watch the show. all I know is people love the show.
And on that
she's
show,
the star.
As much as I love Olivia Pope, but on that show, she's a mistress to the president of the United States. I love Olivia Pope. Don't get me wrong. But where are those positive messages? We had a ton. This is probably why we're sitting here today. We had a ton of those influences. I mean, I went to a historically Black college, and Hillman on The Cosby Show was a fictitious school. But so many of us chose those HBCUs and wanted to be like the Cosbys because of what we saw on television. Where are those outlets for those young women to say, hey, that's who I aspire to be? Then you hop off of television, you go on Instagram. All you've got is Instagram models who are the same complexion as all of us, Black women, you know, exploiting themselves for likes. You've got girls on Instagram who've got 100,000 followers for doing nothing more than wearing nothing.
So do you think, is it harder for girls of color to grow up today?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, indeed.
Than all of us here?
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. That's why our work is so important.
Cheryl,
And in terms of what we do at Everlore House, we had to institute some ingenious, I guess, programming. And we truly believe that programming should be culturally relevant, I think, and that's a lot of what's missing. So a lot of girls knew that their needs weren't being met. And when we talk about public education with the no zero tolerance policy, the reports are also talking about how girls don't feel safe in school. With the metal detection situation, they don't want to go. They actually stay home.
They feel less safe with metal detectors?
With it. Yes, and they're actually also being suspended for being held up at the metal detectors. And then when they get to class next, they're suspended for basically no reason, where the teachers don't have the tolerance. They just have that zero tolerance policy. So, you know, again, that they're being discriminated against across the board. And they know it and they feel it. So some of the things that we instituted in Everlore program, we have two, the personal development program and the workforce development program. One is colorism and identity. That was a powerful class. We actually had to have some psychologists on board to undo some of the stuff. The girls love that. We also have, we bring in new conversation. They had a class on how to get a prestigious education for free and get a high-paying job after you graduate. Now, I wish I had that kind of program, a class. So that, along with bonding exercises to shift the dynamic of what they see and hear in the street. And we have to really take a grassroots approach and constantly tell girls there's a way you act in professional settings and there's a way to act when you're in the street. And they always repeat that. But the comfortable, safe place where there's culturally relevant programmings can help our girls soar. And I must say, we do have girls who have come from really some horrific circumstances, but we've seen 90% of our girls graduate high school on time and get in 4-year colleges.
Wow, that's great.
So when they're in a nurturing environment, they can thrive.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the three of you. That's Cheryl Ann Wadlington, founder of the Philadelphia nonprofit Everlore House. Also with us, Shalia Sutton, founder of the Uniquely You Summit. And Robin Stevens directs Penn's Health Equity and Media Lab, an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Let me get a couple of callers in and I'll read some comments as well. Gigi from Havertown joins us on Radio Times. Gigi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Marty. And I wanted to thank you and to thank these three ladies for being on the show to talk about these topics. I'm calling as the mother of a biracial child, you know, and President Obama once said, you know, when he doesn't take his white mother into the room when he enters. And I feel much the same for my daughter. She is a beautiful young girl of color, growing up with a white mom and no dad in the picture for the most part, and in a very white neighborhood. And she sort of really struggles with all of these external pressures. Your one guest was talking about that, you know, she didn't have access to therapy. And I can tell you that even with access to a lot of therapy, you know, I watch my little girl struggle and I watch her face issues that I know her peers are never in a million years are going to have to face and that I never had to face. And that I am now tasked with having to prepare her to step into the world. So I'm wondering where the panel falls, you know, in terms of the changing landscape of society. People are, you know, there's a lot more mixed race kids. There's a lot more, however you want to phrase it, there's a lot more kids who look different than the white population.
Sure,
and
sure.
They tend to fall through the cracks because, you know, my daughter doesn't really feel like she belongs in the room with all of the little black girls, but she doesn't belong in the room with all the little white girls. And where can we turn to sort of find help for our kids who are, you know, growing up fatherless and growing up struggles and are really going to face a lot of these issues that I'm listening to the panel talk about.
Oh, well, Gigi, I appreciate you raising that point. I'm sure all three of our guests want to jump in on that. Robin, do you have any thoughts, ideas, suggestions for Gigi and her daughter?
Thank you for calling, Gigi. It's clear that you have a great amount of love for your daughter, which I think the love of a strong mother is one of the most powerful things. I don't have evidence except that I have a really strong mother. Hey, Mom. But one thing I would, as you go on this journey with her, consider is even if she does not feel that she fits in, we know that being of color in America is not really about how you feel. It's about how society sees you. And ultimately, depending on how she looks, she will be treated as a black woman, whether she identifies that way or not. So I have found from my small sample of people I know that black communities can be some of the most inclusive places, black churches, it's not exclusionary. And even if you don't feel, if she doesn't feel awkward, I would say continue to push in, because eventually you may find her some surrogate home in a black community that she can pull strength from later.
Shalia, anything you want to add to that?
Absolutely. As Robin said, I certainly, you know, commend you for just, you know, calling here and the bravery and even saying that and even sharing. I think that you've got to, and I know this may sound odd to you, you know, being a white woman, but you are going to have to find ways to affirm her and affirm her in ways that may seem foreign to you. But you're going to have to, you know, do that. You're going to have to talk to her about her hair type and really find women, even if you've got to Google that while she's at school, and find women who look like her, you know, and affirm her hair, affirm her color, affirm her complexion, you know, tell her about where she comes from. You know, even if, you know, it's not one place in particular, because as black people, we really truly don't know where we come from. But I mean, just being of African American descent or being of black descent, really delving into that and being excited about that with her. I have twin children, a boy and a girl, and I'm raising them in a predominantly white area. And I'm not telling you something that I haven't done. I might not be a white woman, but I have to affirm my children constantly because of the area that we live in. We live in that area because of the school district. I can't afford private school, but what I can do is afford to live in an area, you know, where the school district is decent. And so it is a constant affirmation that I'm doing. Sometimes it's just, you know, in telling my daughter how beautiful her puffs look today, or encouraging my son to wear his hair natural and encouraging him, you know, telling him how magical that black people are. The fact that our hair doesn't defy gravity, nothing in the world doesn't defy gravity. So you're going to have to get creative, you know, with those things. But I encourage you to just affirm her as much as you possibly can. And it may very well feel like you've done that in some spaces, but you've got to keep on doing it. One day she's going to appreciate you. And one day she's going to be sitting here where we are talking about how her white mother made her feel like being a black woman was the best thing on the planet.
Let me just read a couple of comments here. I'm sure you have something to say, Cheryl, but I'll read a couple of comments. An email from a listener in New Jersey. It's a social issue. However, Camden and the county have more special high schools, libraries, and state infrastructure than any other city in New Jersey. A tweet from Nathan. This may seem controversial, but I think we need to be more aggressively pushing to reduce the number of kids born into poverty by teen moms. Would you agree with that, disagree with that? And that's a very complicated issue.
Yeah, that is a complicated dynamic. But I guess I'm, and we ladies are more interested with what we have to deal with now. And I think what we do, our work will have a will trickle down to help the next generation. But in regards to the caller, and what you said was so magnificent, Shalaya, but I think we also need to bring into the conversation, how do we raise powerful girls? And I think that's the question maybe your caller can think about. And she can even Google information for just some quick tips. What can I do to raise a powerful girl?
Fair enough. And Gigi, sorry, there was just a very pregnant pause there. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. But it is about, I mean, we're almost up in a break here, you talked, Robin, about just having a powerful mom. And just to underscore the fact that family, you know, however we define it, family is so important for kids growing up.
Absolutely. And the research bears this out. That's really not a question. But the beauty of it is family can be biological or could be chosen. So we don't have to be forced into a parent you're born with. And I think that's why the work of my guests are so wonderful, because they are choosing to build family around girls that aren't their biological children. And that is that mentorship relationship can be as wonderful and can really be a bridge the same way that the family can be a bridge.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about raising girls of color, helping them to build their self-esteem, grow into strong and successful women. Robin Stevens, Shalaya Sutton, and Cheryl Ann Wadlington are guests. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with three women who are leading the way, helping minority girls build their self-esteem to grow into strong and successful women. And the stats show that young women of color face a unique set of challenges and barriers. And again, Cheryl Ann Wadlington, the founder of Evalor House, recently named a champion of change by the White House. Shalaya Sutton, founder of the annual Uniquely You Summit, and Robin Stevens from the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, where she directs Penn's Health Equity and Media Lab. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Regina from Princeton to join us. Regina, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. I just want the women to address the kinds of predatory nature of black men in the community that sexualize young black women at the age of 12 as soon as their bodies develop. I don't know how you're addressing that,
sure.
But
no,
that's something I'm kind of interested in or want to hear about.
Absolutely, Regina. Appreciate the call to Radio Times. Cheryl, do you want to take that?
Yeah.
Well, we could do an hour on this.
We sure can. That's a very interesting, historically laced question, because you're talking about something that has been going on since the beginning of America with the men's preference for younger girls. So in terms of and it's interesting because I see, too, how girls are kind of and sometimes drawn towards that. But we actually work on building self-esteem and being smart, being strong and smart and making wise decisions. And again, I think the environment that culturally relevant programming and educating our girls, it matters and it makes all the difference, because if they don't hear it from the right source, they're going to listen to what they hear in the street. And a lot of this behavior is a result of what young girls hear in the street. Now, I do know, you know, we've found out at several times that the girls, some of the girls were on certain social medias changing their age.
Making themselves older?
Oh, yeah. Saying they were over 18 and actually talking about how they were dating guys that were older. And so, you know, we have high confidentiality in our program amongst the girls, but the parents didn't know that it was actually like a group in the whole wealthy neighborhood where the girls had a little social media club. And they all were doing this and dating older men.
Hmm. Shalia, anything you want to add to that?
A huge part of the work we do is helping girls understand rape culture and what that is. And for me, the caller asked, you know, for us to talk about that as it relates to Black men. And I'm going to say I'm uncomfortable completely pinning that on them. And because Black women have been exploited since, you know, slavery, since we were brought to this country. I mean, Black women were raped. Black women were used as, you know, birthing machines to, you know, birth children, you know, to be born as slaves. And so I think a lot of the sexual exploitation of Black women has so much to do with just time, you know, the way the Black women have just their bodies have just been exploited since the beginning of time. I think that there was a teacher. I think they were calling her Teacher Bay. That was the hashtag that was being used on social media. It was a first grade teacher who had, you know, relatively large breasts and a large bottom. And what was happening was on social media, she was being bullied. And they were telling her that that was inappropriate for her to dress that way for the first grade. And I'm saying all she did was put clothes on a curvy body that just so happens to belong to her. So a lot of what we do is teach girls and help them to understand and dissect rape culture and how there isn't any response on Black women for the way that they were born as it relates to body structure.
Robin, anything you want to add to that?
I agree with Shalia on, I think this is not really about a Black men issue. I think this is a male issue.
Yeah. Regina, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Well, here's a tough one for you. If I can put this to you, Robin, a tweet from an interested listener. What is the solution for the digital hood, and I think all of us are struggling with the digital neighborhoods mm-hmm. that we all live in and how rough it can be, frankly, online.
And I didn't mention the part of the digital hood that I love. So this is the first time in recent history that young people have been able to create their own content, some of which is hilarious and insightful, and the advocacy and the activism that wouldn't happen without social media, it has given young Black and brown communities a voice that they could have never got when we were just 3, 6, 10, and 12, right? So we don't want to miss that, and we don't want to miss the collective activism that can come from that. There's great work going on in youth communities, and that's what we need to be highlighting, building, giving them opportunities to learn how to do the tech side so that they can be more controllers of the content, so that they can be more builders of platforms. Because realistically, in Silicon Valley, when they build platforms, they're not thinking about how is it going to reverberate in North Philly or Camden. That's not on the radar. And even if it comes to the radar, it's not really that important.
So use the technology to your own benefit,
so,
right?
So I say we should push to owning it, working it. And we've been doing some great work in that space. But it is really more about highlighting that instead of highlighting the Real Housewives. Like, let's highlight the Grapevine stars who are doing some excellent stuff.
Let me get Tim from Havertown to join our conversation. And Tim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi,
thanks very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
It's just an intensely interesting conversation.
Great.
I am an instructor in a suburban university, and I talk a lot about white privilege in my classes because I have a predominantly white classroom just because of the demographics of the school that I'm at. And I find myself, when I talk about it's so tempting to sort of exaggerate I feel this on the right and the left, the leverage, the experience of Black Americans for their own political gains, and tend to make it extravagantly tragic, one to gin up fear, the other to gin up support, which might be well-meaning, but it perpetuates this idea of the devastation of the Black community. So when I try to talk about this in class to get my students' attention about what white privilege is, I either fall into the trap of over-exaggerating how terrible things are in the Black community, or when I talk about successes and try to accentuate that tends to fall into the trap of, well, these are just Black students who try. These are just the black students who have their act together, and therefore it's the support of the American dream, where you just, if you just work hard enough, you can succeed. And so I'm wondering from your guests if they can talk to me a little bit about how to talk about success within the black community, in this case, women, black women in the community, without falling into that trap that these are just the women who know how to do the American dream.
Tim, it's such an interesting question. Cheryl, I'm going to toss that first to you, but I'm sure everyone else wants to weigh in as well.
Yeah, honest conversation. And I found, I actually went in the classroom and taught last semester, and I was amazed when you create a safe place. And, you know, I tell the girls, this is your classroom, you know, it's confidentiality here. What stays here is, you know, will not go outside this room. And also, we talk about differences in people. I think that's has a lot to do with where you'll be able to get, have an understanding in the classroom, and you can have that great dialogue where it's not challenging, challenges coming from both ends. But in terms of, you know, the white privilege thing, I'm so happy that this is being talked about, but it really needs to be in an environment where everyone feels okay and comfortable, and it can be like rich dialogue, you know, you can agree to disagree. And I think that's up to the teacher to lead it and to create that a calm environment, because it's a heated topic.
Absolutely. And not to politicize it, but as Tim was describing this, I was thinking how Donald Trump has been describing the African-American communities, if it's all about crime and all the problems of crime. And it's clear that that is not the entire picture. At the same time, what I'm hearing from the three of you is that certainly girls of color growing up in poverty face barriers, obstacles, challenges. Shalia.
He's only reiterating, Donald Trump is only reiterating what the media is showing everybody, is showing the world. And I think that when you don't have access to black community and you don't have access to black places, then your only access oftentimes is the media. And so he's sort of just, you know, capitalizing on the on what the media really already shows us. So you don't see CNN highlighting black women. You don't even see CNN having any black female anchors. Name one since Soledad O'Brien. I think Angela Ryan, I think right now she's just a commentator. So, you know, they're not seeing black women in those spaces, unfortunately. And, you know, you don't have, I think, as a white person who is not around black people, that is just a common association. And I don't blame them for feeling that way. It's the same, you know, with the work that we do. There are times that I'm unable to empathize with certain situations that are not black when it comes to young women, because I'm not a young white woman. I'm not a young Asian woman. I understand the plight and some of the journeys of black girls because I was a black girl and now a black woman.
Robin, you want to add something?
Yes. Tim?
Tim.
Tim, okay. So, Tim, it sounds like you're struggling trying to find a space between focusing on black exceptionalism and black tragedy. And I would really commend you for working in this tough space, because I know that's not easy to teach. My approach is I focus on system. So instead of focusing on individual, there's only one Oprah Winfrey and we all claim her, but she's really, she is exceptional in spite of. So if we focus on the systematic differences, and that's what's so powerful about collecting data accurately and collecting data by race and gender, we can see where there are systematic patterns instead of focusing on anecdotal successes.
So true. Fair enough. Tim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Not that this is easy to do, but Cheryl, and I'll start with you here, which is that if you want to make life better for kids, all kids, we got to address the problem of poverty.
Oh, you really do.
And again, to just reiterate, Philadelphia is the highest rate of poverty of the top 10 big cities. Something like a quarter of this population, the city here, and of them, a sizable percentage living in extreme poverty.
Extreme poverty.
Extreme poverty.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, not that I want to put much more pressure on the city than what they already have, but it needs to be discussed because, again, our girls are hurting, and we have a high rate of girls being funneled into the juvenile justice system. In terms of putting in programming, supporting organizations, extracurricular activities and programs that can empower, educate, and help girls to thrive. We don't have them here. And I know we have our recreation centers, but I've worked in them for years, and I can't say that that's some place that I would send my daughter.
Really?
You know, and I don't even know if they have the money to invest the quality program. Now, here's another question that I can raise. It tends to be that if you are a young girl from a high poverty or what they call violent reduction neighborhood, do you deserve a good education, or should we just help you to get by, like, you know, to get tokens, to go get a job, that kind of mentality? So I find that we have to change the conversation, change the dynamic, as well as the education, to do more to believe that just because you happen to have been born in a certain zip code, that you have the potential to attend Harvard University. So I don't see that conversation there, but I also think it should shift to that, and to give that girl the same type of hope that someone who is might have white privilege.
Let me get another caller, and this is Loretta calling us from Mount Laurel. Loretta, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi,
thank you.
You're welcome.
Great discussion. This needs to be talked about. But I just wanted to see if we can give a shout out to Sasha and Malia Obama, who are great role models for all black young girls. And I would hope to see more of them after Obama leaves office, which I am pretty sad about, but it's going to come. So,
sure.
Can we talk about them a little bit?
Absolutely. Ashley, you want to talk about Sasha and Malia Obama?
Oh, wow. That's interesting. It's very, very interesting. I like to call them, I'd say, free black children.
Free. They've been freed?
No, free as in, you know, they're living their lives, and they're doing it unapologetically. And, you know, they've gone through a lot, I feel like, as, you know, the president's daughters, but I love to see their unapologeticness. You know, if you know what I'm referring to with Malia Obama being in the news recently, just allowing her to be a young person. Sometimes I think that black girls, and I call the work that we do with black girls and not black women, because I think often young black women, because I think oftentimes we want to associate this older kind of influence with black girls. I say girls because they are. I think really black girls are really the only ones that get called young women a lot before it's time. And I like to, I'm very happy to see Malia and Sasha really be unapologetic black girls. I love that.
But it was very interesting.
And we're
that,
almost out of time.
No.
I'm sorry. Let me just tell Sister Robin. I want to give you just the last word.
Oh, on that?
On that.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
I don't think I should.
You should? Okay. No. Well, then I'll give the last word to you, Cheryl.
Well, you know, it was interesting because Sasha and Malia had encountered a lot of the racism that is prevalent in America when one of the other parties had actually tore her daughters apart for what they wore and had said that the girls were dressing unsophisticated. So they even had to encounter what we're saying girls of color face in terms of someone else dictating who they're supposed to be, what they're supposed to wear, and how they're supposed to look. And that's part of the psychosis that's happening, and it's real.
Well, we have to end our conversation on that note. My thanks to all three of you. Cheryl Ann Wadlington, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Congratulations on your award, Champion of Change from the White House. And she's the founder of the Philadelphia nonprofit Evalor House. Shalia Sutton, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Pat.
You're welcome. And she's founder of the Uniquely You Summit. And Robin Stevens, thank you for coming in as well. And she is an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. She directs Penn's Health, Equity, and Media Lab. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. I see lots of comments here, so it looks like we have a vigorous conversation taking place on our social media. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks for joining us.